Welcome to Animals Today, your home for serious talk about animals. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. Every fall when I see the local news coverage on the blessing of the animals, I think to myself, is that all? And what really is the benefit? Regardless, we here at Animals Today are pleased that interest in our religious lives related to animals and how we treat and coexist with them is growing. This is reflected in books, university courses, online publications, and discussions. We have discussed various aspects of animals and religion on prior Animals Today shows as well. Thankfully, we are moving away from the beliefs of St. Thomas Aquinas, who held that animals were intended for human use. Still, with the teachings of overall compassion and of kindness towards animals specifically being part of many religions, one could reasonably expect that people would treat animals better than we do. We've been reading a very fine book titled Animals and World Religions that surveys many religious beliefs and practices about animals and also asks us to go further in our animal advocacy. Now, later in the show, should we kill wildlife in the name of conservation? But first, I am pleased to welcome the author of Animals and World Religions, Lisa Kimura. Lisa is currently Associate Professor of Philosophy and Religions at Montana State University, Billings. She's the author and editor of half a dozen books on animal advocacy, ethics, and religion. Welcome to the program, Lisa.
Thank you very much. I'm excited to be here.
Lisa, one of the intriguing things about your book, Animals and World Religions, is that it's much more than a description. It's a call to action on behalf of animals. Why did you write this book?
Well, because people who hold to one religion or another should have a call to action. There's no question that religions, all of them are active. It's something to be lived. And it's no less true that, in fact, the situation of animals and what this calls people of religions to do is overlooked and neglected.
Right. Now, most animal activists are not religious. In our experience, many have dropped out of their religions when they become activists. Why do you, as an activist, focus on religion?
Well, I'm a teacher, so I teach religion courses, I teach ethics courses. I work in a very conservative, largely Christian area. There's my experience, there's no question. When I'm dealing with someone who is of a religious tradition and takes it seriously, in this case, almost always Christians, when they're of the Christian faith, I can work with them much more easily than I can if they're secular or don't really care about whatever religion they're part of. And, you know, it's easy to see why when you pause to think about it. If you're of a religion, if you have a faith that teaches you, say, Christianity, that love is the foundational moral principle of Christianity. If love is your foundational moral principle, you cannot turn your back on the suffering that you're causing in your particular life. And so whereas people who I have in my classes that are secular can say, well, yeah, they're suffering, I don't really care. I'm going to go on doing what I'm doing. A person who professes Christianity cannot do that.
Right. Very good. With all the ideas in many religions about treating animals kindly, one might think we humans would not treat them so horribly, and yet we do. I bet you've thought a lot about that. So share your ideas.
You mean why we treat them badly, even though we do? We are creatures of religions?
Right.
Yes. Well, humans are never quite live into anything fully. I think humans can ruin any good religion. I don't think we live into them because, well, if you look at I can look at my own life. When I look at all of my shortcomings, the things that I wish I could do better and I don't, it's easy for me to see why someone who is of a religion such as Christianity and just walks the walk with everybody around them who's not living into what the teachings say about animals, it's easy to do that. There's no one to jar you, to point it out. There's nothing to push you. It's easier. It's far more comfortable than starting to take a stand against fellow church members. So I think it's just a laziness and an ease of life. And I understand it. I'm human, too. I get how much harder my life is living here in Billings, Montana, as an animal activist and ethicist than it would be if I could just go along with others. But I can't.
Right. Now, Lisa, you devote a lengthy and excellent appendix to factory farming and fishing with compelling facts, fact-based arguments opposing these practices. How do the faithful relate to these ideas?
In my experience, they take it seriously. The ones, again, it depends. If you're a person of serious faith, you will take this seriously. And I have a fairly good track record with serious Christians in getting them to rethink how they treat animals in my classroom when I present to them the information from their religion. And if they take their religion seriously, they will take that seriously, and it can bring change usually in diet. And I notice it. It's visible.
Yeah.
So when they learn this stuff, they are, I'm sorry, when they learn this, they are shocked and appalled. They don't know about it.
Mm. Yeah. And are they receptive?
Yeah, somewhat. They argue, they complain. In my classes, they're always required. All of my classes cover animals in some capacity, and I require them to see clips, online clips from Mercy for Animals, or one of the ones is taken from what's actually going on. And of course, they say, oh, this never happens. Oh, this is just it's a one-off. I'm on a cattle ranch. I know this doesn't happen. Then I just start asking them a few questions about their cattle ranch, and I start asking them a few questions about what they do and don't know. And I point out that really there's never a time that you never go undercover and don't find abuse. And then we talk about why that is. Why, if you're put in a position where you constantly have to abuse, you're going to have to turn off your feelings. It's going to elicit more cruelty. And I'm able to work them around to a position where they can bring down the walls and start facing that not only is this likely, it's highly probable, you know, that this is happening in our industries because of the nature of them. They are bloody. They're ugly. We're killing one after another as fast as we can. Of course the people working there are callous, and of course what they're seeing in this video really is happening, and it really is horrible.
And you're in such a prime position to do that. That's so great of you. Lisa,
good, sitting
so
in ranching
much
country.
Of human... Yeah, exactly. So much of human history over the millennia relied upon our use and indeed our exploitation of animals. And in the 20th century, finally, we achieved the ability to break free of these habits, to use machines instead of animal labor, to abstain from eating all animal products if we choose, and so on. And yet, the traditional religions with their ancient roots and traditions and customs do not seem equipped or even interested in dealing with the contemporary ideas about animal welfare and animal rights. What's your thoughts about that?
It's a great point. It's a great question. You can always find something in Scripture that will hearken you back to bad ways, to worse ways, that will call you to keep on doing what you're doing no matter how bad it is. You can find that. There's no doubt about it. There's also no doubt that if you look at the actual roots, the core moral teachings, and if you care about what's more important versus less important, so sure, you can find examples of, say, Jesus eating fish, and you can say, look, Jesus ate fish, so I can keep eating fish. But the point is, if you walked Jesus over and showed him, here's our seas, here's what's actually happening, here's the ecosystems, here's the damage we're doing, here's bycatch, here's all the things, here's the problems with the fishing industry, Jesus wouldn't say, well, I'm going to go right on eating fish because that's what I did before.
Right.
That would be the point, that the moral teachings are strong and they require us to bring change where change is necessary when we're doing something that bumps up against those moral teachings.
Lisa, what are you hoping your book will accomplish?
Change a few people, help the animals, bring a little less suffering in the world, make people aware. If they really are religious and they really do care about their relationship with God or their commitment to the afterlife, whatever it is in their religion, that they can bring that in line with what they're doing with animals.
Why should animal advocates care about religion or religious practices and beliefs?
For that very reason, you can change people. And it's a shame that because we've turned away from religion, and I understand that, it's frustrating. It's frustrating having someone, this Christmas, I was flamingly irritated. I just felt an annoyance when I sent out Christmas cards to especially my Christian friends. I was very clear with them. You know, you've known me a long time. You've been hearing about this stuff, and you're going right on eating meat. Don't talk to me about love unless you're going to bring it into action. So if we understand what the basic teachings are of the people that we know who have a strong commitment to religion, we can bring change in their lives, and in that way we can help the animals. But if we don't know those basic teachings, then we can't utilize that to bring change for the animals.
Is there one religion that is most friendly to animals? And we only have a few seconds here, and after the break, I'm going to explore with you a few topics from your book. But is there one religion that really is the most friendly to our animal friends?
The short answer is no. They're all beautiful. They all have wonderful teachings that can help animals, help us, and help us help animals.
Lisa Kimura, don't go away. You're listening to Animals Today. Welcome back to Animals Today. We're here with Lisa Kimura, Associate Professor of Philosophy and Religions at Montana State University, Billings, and also author of Animals and World Religions. Lisa, was Thomas Aquinas wrong on animals?
He absolutely was. If you know the history of that, Aquinas took that from Aristotle's teachings. Was Aristotle a Christian? He was pre-Christian. So the answer is he was very interested in philosophy. He applied something to Christianity that is completely not applicable. What Aristotle taught was that everything is here for a purpose. So the grass is here for the deer, and the deer are here for us to eat them, or the cows, or whatever. And Aquinas simply added, you know, we are here. It's all ultimately for God. But again, it's utilitarian. It has absolutely nothing to do with the teachings of Jesus or Christianity more generally.
I'd like to explore with you a few topics from your book, if that's okay.
That'd be wonderful.
In your chapter on indigenous traditions, the section on the Great Peace is fascinating. Can you tell us about these stories?
Give me some feedback as to which ones you're talking about so I can tag on the stories themselves. You mean the Great Peace as in the peace that existed before people started hunting?
That's correct.
Yes, okay.
Please.
All right, so the Great Peace, this is an absolutely beautiful part of religions, and it's part of all of them, that all religions recognize that there is something not so good about eating other animals. Now, of course, we have to see this in context. When you're struggling to find something to eat and you don't have a lot to eat, then you're going to need to eat other animals if you can't find anything else, and I accept that. I mean, the people who went down in the plane in the Andes ate other people. It's understandable when you are hungry that you will eat what you can find. Nonetheless, they recognize that it would be better if they weren't doing that. So myths, whether it's scripture that talks about the fall of humankind, or whether there's myths, as there are in every religion tradition, that explain why we eat other animals, you can see in human beings that agony, that moral anguish over killing and eating other animals and the question of why we do so. So this is a beautiful thing. And, of course, the great thing is now we don't need to eat animals. So it doesn't matter what kind of, you know, whether you're a Native American or a Christian. Now we don't need to do it. So we can look back and say, yes, there was a time when our myths explained why we did this, and now we don't need to. And this, of course, is the beauty of understanding your tradition and the core moral teachings.
Can you go on to speak about traditional Hindu practices and beliefs related to animals and explain ahimsa, reincarnation and karma?
I sure can. And those are the ones I would tag on immediately as the easiest to grasp and the most important when dealing with animal issues. So ahimsa, not to harm, it's just a core teaching. And it, again, whereas Christians ask you to love, and this is a more demanding, we only apply it to humans. Of course, attrition itself doesn't, but Christians tend to. So ahimsa, not to harm, it asks less, but it is universal, and they understand it as universal, that you cannot harm any living being. Anything that can be harmed, you must not harm. And this is rooted then in the idea of karma simply means action. So your actions then determine what happens to you in your future lives, reincarnation, that you'll be reborn. And you can be reborn as anything. So you can be living with a dog or a sheep or the squirrel out in your yard, and that's going to be a relative of yours from a past life. and respecting those relations and knowing that that life inside that body is no different than your own. It's just in a different body. So these are beautiful teachings from the Hindu tradition that help us to respect and care for other animals.
Gandhi was a vegetarian, nearly vegan, as you write. What did he say about his diet?
He was a wonderfully experimental human being. So he would, I think if he were sitting here, he'd say his life was an experiment with diet, that he kept revising and working on his diet and thinking about how his moral, his ethics and his practices should fit together with what he ate. So he had a tendency towards simplicity and moving away from luxury. So he got simpler and simpler, and what he generally tended to eat was like simply a handful of nuts. He was a minimalist. He ate very little. And the only animal products that he partook of were goat's milk, and he only did that at the insistence of his wife. He would not have chosen that. For example, at one point he drank milk. He didn't think there was anything wrong with that. And later he learned more about it, and he quit drinking milk. And of course, he was raised without meat because he was raised Hindu, and most Hindus are raised without meat, although that's changing a little bit thanks to our horrible influence. But he would sneak off with some of his Muslim friends when he was a kid, and he would eat meat, and he would feel horribly guilty. So he had this influence from other religions. He had Muslim friends. He had friends from the Jain tradition, which was even more compassionate. And between those, he ended up realizing the importance of ahimsa and that what he ate really mattered to his following those foundational religious beliefs.
What are Buddhists teaching about consuming animals? Are Buddhists supposed to be vegan?
Yeah, it's very disappointing that a religion so clearly animal-friendly and so clearly vegan is generally not practicing a vegan diet. You know, again, you just have to know that humans are humans, and they'll find excuses where they can, and they'll look for that one line that they can try to lean on that ignores the overall moral teachings and do what they want to do. And that's kind of, especially when you look at American Buddhists, it's just shameful how they will justify, ignore, and carry on eating whatever they want to eat, irregardless of foundational teachings like ahimsa.
Lisa, in my introduction, I mentioned the blessing of the animals conducted in remembrance of St. Francis of Assisi. What happens, and what is the point, and who benefits from this?
Well, it's a pretty watered-down attempt by the mainstream to include animals, but I guess from my perspective, I would say it's a jumping-off point for us, if we understand Christianity, to engage with people who think this is a good thing, to talk to them about why and to pull in things like Genesis 1:29, where God creates a vegan world, where God creates a world where the divine being is invested in that world so that we have moral responsibility. And again, this is where education comes in for all of us who are activists, not just about religions, but about issues more generally. We have to understand links between harming the environment and our diet, so that we can pull that in. And poverty, so if we talk to Christians, one of the strongest points when we're talking to people of, especially of Christianity, but of faith in general, is that when we're eating animals, we feed 70% of our grain crop in this country to animals, 70%. It's completely wasted. It doesn't come back in any caloric gain because the animals, you know, they move around. They grow things like hair and hooves that we can't eat. If you want to feed the hungry, the way to do it is to feed that 70% to the world hungry, not to feed it to cattle and pigs and chickens and then eat them. So understanding things like that, they're strong talking points for people of faith. So you take something like the blessing of the animals and you say, okay, this is pretty lame because they're going to go home and have their chicken McNuggets. But I'm going to use it as a talking point to say, why are we doing this? What's behind this? This idea of love and compassion, where should it really be going?
Yeah. Lisa, the book is fantastic, Animals and World Religions. Thank you so much for appearing on Animals Today. Lisa Kamira, Animals and World Religions.
You guys are awesome. Keep up the good work. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Lisa. Don't go away. After the break, should we kill wildlife in the name of conservation? You're listening to Animals Today. Okay. Don't go away after the... Don't go away after the break. Should we kill wildlife in the name of conservation? You're listening to Animals Today. Welcome back to Animals Today. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. Peter, you're sitting there like you have something on your mind you want to say.
I have a lot on my mind, particularly related to the hunting black rhino news.
Isn't that incredible?
This is probably the biggest story of the week, whereby a member, leader of the Dallas Safari Club, which is a private organization that likes to hunt mostly captive wild animals or go around the world and hunting them. This fellow is named Corey Knowlton, right? So he's been his face has been all over the news and social media. He won a lottery, not a lottery, he won an auction by pledging $350 to the country of Namibia to get a permit to allow him to go to the country and hunt and kill one particular black rhino.
You said $350. I think you mean $350,000.
$350,000.
Right,
thank
right.
You. So,
to
right.
kill
it
one...
gets me a little crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
So, right, to kill one particular older black rhino who is allegedly a little bit aggressive, no longer breeding, and the rationale, you've probably heard, is to raise money that will be funneled back for conservation efforts in the country.
So this $350,000 is supposed to be used to help conservation.
That's right.
To and kill this animal.
Right, to kill this animal as a trophy.
Now,
right.
What sense does that make?
Well, you know, there are justifications being presented.
Tell me.
Such as this particular rhino. No one's going to miss this particular rhino.
I'm going to miss him.
Well, yes, and he's probably not going to want to be hunted himself.
Right.
But the justification also goes to that the money is needed. Poaching is a very serious problem in the country. They need the funds to protect the remaining herd. It's an endangered species. The numbers have shrunk by a large percentage over the past decades, they're trying to make it a conservation idea. So a lot of controversy about that because, first of all, now the Knowlton is claiming that he's received death threats.
From animal advocates.
Yes, and individuals too. In fact, he's been on the news complaining, and he's had to go into hiding. Because there are some very unhappy people. He presented a Facebook message, which has been reprinted in the news, which said, and I'll just quote here, "I'm sending you an open invitation. I live in blank and would be happy for you to come and show me what a man you are. I understand you receive a lot of death threats. This is not one of them. The things I can do will make the movies come to mind. Anything, you're ready, tough guy." So it's sort of veiled threats, okay? But he's received actual death threats as well. And he's afraid. He's afraid for his family. He says his family's being threatened. And so I wonder, what do you expect? I mean, he's living in his little bubble of co-hunters who take great pleasure in bagging. He claims to have killed at least 120 different species in his life. He works as an advisor on a hunting television show. So this is his life, and he's surrounded by like-minded people.
Right.
So if you want to go public with this, I mean, you're a little naive not to understand where this is going to go, right?
Yeah.
So I want to ask you, Dr. Kirshner, what do you think about individuals who might come out and issue, veiled or actual death threats. What's your opinion on that?
You know, I don't know. I'm glad it's happening. I would never do it myself, but it's fine. It's fine. I'm not gonna judge the people that do that at this time. How about you?
Well, I would never do it myself.
Right. Of course not.
We advocate for animals. We are not. We're not into
violent means,
violence,
right?
Threats, or
right?
Anything like that.
Okay? Right.
We like to be positive. It doesn't surprise me at all that this is happening. And if someone not related to me or not associated with me wants to do it, I wouldn't get in their way.
Right.
I think they're of. That's what they want to do. That's fine.
That's right. It sends a message, and you know.
But it's a little reality check for this fellow and his group. I mean, what do you want? Now he's got his logic, and he on some level truly believes that in his world of quote unquote conservation, this might be a beneficial thing. But remember, his notion and the notion of these hunters' view of conservation is not the way most people understand conservation to be, right? They want the species to be perpetuated so they can continue hunting them.
Right.
That's conservation.
That's their logic.
That's the logic, and that is a crazy definition of that word.
But as we spoke about before on this show, hunters will use any excuse to hunt and kill, right? They'll say anything.
Yes.
Control the herd. Control the population. Control...
Family. Good family event.
Good family event.
Right. Getting out in nature.
Getting close to your kids.
Right.
Or I love animals. Oh, that's a good one. I love animals, so I want to hunt them. I want to kill them, right?
Right.
Hope they don't love me. So going back to the death threat, you know, again, I want to emphasize we do not purport violence in terms of trying to get our message through. Peter, are death threats illegal?
Yes, I would say that I believe that you cannot do that.
Right.
Right. And some of them are coming semi-anonymously. You probably could find out who made them if someone was interested in doing this.
Right.
It'd be quite a project. And there are ways to get your message through without going on social media, in the old-fashioned way.
Do you think getting out in the media that death threats are occurring for this towards this guy, that it will prevent something like this from happening in the future, that it will dissuade people from wanting to accept these auctions or bid in these auctions and kill the animals in the name of conservation?
Right. I do think that's a good question. I think this is a useful exercise because Corey Knowlton apparently is surprised by this reaction. And I believe he's surprised, as I mentioned before, because he's living in a little cocoon surrounded by like-minded people. And he has not exposed these ideas to the general public. Okay, he's on his hunting channel, very limited audience. He's a member of his club. All these members understand his notion of conservation and see no harm in hunting. It's part of their lives. Okay, but now go out into the rest of the world and you realize you're sort of not in sync and you're going to evoke a lot of anger. So I think that was a surprise to him, perhaps a surprise to a lot of his colleagues. And it's going to be hard for someone to replicate this.
Yeah.
Especially when they start talking about your family and your children. That's scary, even if you're big macho game hunter.
It sure is. You know, big difference, I think, in the way a mind like his works and a mind like an animal advocate works is we see this rhino as an individual.
Right.
As an individual.
Right.
Someone that can feel, someone that it's a sentient being,
right.
Someone that can feel fear and pain, and this individual matters.
Right.
To them, they don't see it as an individual.
Right. Right, very true, and I would like to add further that this $350,000 is a lot of money for the Namibian cause. Okay, they would like this to protect their rhinos. The animal advocacy community ought to look at this and say, you know what, we need to figure out a way to raise money better and faster, because it's really a shame that it takes this crazy hunter, well, whatever, this individual, who happens to have the funds to do this. To pony up $350,000.
So if you think the animal advocacy community came up with $350,000, say, okay, here it is. We're gonna donate this to conservation for the rhino, the species of rhino. You think that would have prevented this auction to happen?
Yeah, I think so. I think there needs to be a better mechanism to get all the people in social media who care about animals to throw, maybe through crowdfunding or a little fundraiser, throw in $5 or $10. There are a million people who would do it, and we could totally change the dialogue.
Okay, I agree with that, but I also think it still would have happened. They still would have figured out a way to hunt this animal.
Or hunt some other animal.
Right. Or say, okay, I'm going to match these animal advocates. Here's $350. I'm going to kill another species of the rhino, and we'll do it that way. You know? Figure out some way. It's still going to happen.
Well, if I'm in the government of Namibia, and I could take a look at what a furor this has caused, I would like to step aside and try to partner better with the wealthy European and North American animal advocates and ask them to and coordinate some fundraising effort.
Very good.
So,
thanks, Peter.
I'll let you know what happens.
All right, please do. And more news after the break, right?
Oh, lots of hot news items.
Okay, don't go away.
Another timeless classic
about
animals. Welcome back to Animals Today. Hi, Lori.
Hi. What's in the news today, Peter?
Well, I wanted to start with a dog. Governor Christie's been in the news a lot recently.
He's been dancing
furiously. But he did have time to sign Dusty's Law. Dusty's Law is a new law in New Jersey, which is a...
Is Christie an animal lover or a dog lover?
I think he's... I haven't heard anything particularly about him and animals.
Okay.
It's a good question.
Okay. I mean, I know he eats animals, but...
Yes.
Go ahead.
I would say. Dusty's Law makes it a criminal matter to... if a service animal is injured or killed while working, it makes it a criminal matter, and the police have to get involved. It governs any animal that attacks, injures, or interferes with any kind of service dog, including during training. And this is because these dogs, first of all, frequently are attacked or bothered by other animals while they're on the job. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's because they're trained to stay by their people, and they're trained to be non-aggressive, and they are just sort of sitting ducks for other animals, other dogs frequently to attack them, and it happens a lot. A group called Seeing Eye said that more than 80% of dog users said they had some kind of interference by another animal.
Because another animal sees them, they want to play.
Play or attack. I mean, they don't really defend themselves. Whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. So... Now the police have to, instead of just animal services, which is frequently not available in evenings or weekends, now it's a police matter, and they have to come to the rescue. And then there are penalties, including prison sentences and big fines under the law for interfering with guide dogs. So there you go.
You know, I see a guide dog, I just want to give it a big hug.
I know.
Is that interference?
That is interference. We may call the police on you.
Oh.
Yeah.
So, obviously, Christy sees, a guide dog as being worth a lot more than just a regular companion animal.
That's right.
Right?
They go through a lot of expensive training.
Yeah.
And they're protecting a blind person who needs it. Usually, they're visually impaired.
Okay, good for Christy. I'd like him to step up to the plate and maybe defend animals in another way.
Yeah. Sochi Olympics are coming up soon in
Russia. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Everyone's pretty excited about the possible terrorist threats.
Nervous, yeah.
And our interest in this is, of course, the killer whales that are, two of them, that have been captured in north of Japan and being shipped over to an aquarium in Sochi.
Why?
For the viewing and amusement of visitors.
That's absolutely ridiculous.
And this is a special time for Sochi, so they wanted to make sure they had a few killer whales.
So they captured whales from the sea in the
like
wild.
Yes, they usually do, take them from their pods, and then put them in captivity, and then they allow people to view them and marvel at their beauty.
I think that's terrible.
You better believe it. More than 100,000 people have signed an online petition, which will probably do nothing. And the immense suffering these whales will endure, the transport, and then going, I mean...
It's terrible.
I know. Just another flavor of animal abuse.
It is another flavor of animal abuse. Has Olympics ever done this before? Anywhere?
Well,
anyone?
This is not, you know, this is not an official Olympic event. This is sort of a satellite sort of feature attraction.
No, I understand that.
Okay.
But has the Olympics... exploited animals in any other way,
I don't know.
In the past.
I don't know, like the college teams still using live bull mascots or stuff like that.
Yeah, you know, for example.
I don't recall seeing that.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and what are they going to do with the whales afterwards? You know they're not going to put them back in the ocean, right?
No, I don't think they'll put them back in the ocean. They'll probably get sold to some other place or die in captivity.
Exactly.
Like, yeah.
So sad. So ignorant.
In India, they're making some progress related to animal welfare. They have finally banned animal-tested cosmetics, so they're stepping in line with the EU in this regard. It's sort of hard to avoid the snowball of EU sanctions if you want to do business with them. So they are no longer testing on animals. They do need to take the next step, which is banning outsourcing of animal testing to the remainder countries, but that is the next step. That will inevitably happen. So this is just a process that's going around the world. You don't really need animal testing for cosmetics.
You don't need it
sure.
at all.
And the animals are tortured. They end up dead, and it's just an anachronistic thing that has to end.
Yeah, it's senseless.
So that's a good step for India. Thank you. In Eau Claire, Wisconsin, you know, here's something that I hadn't thought about much, and that is if you confiscate animals from an animal abuse case, let's say a hoarder or a legal breeder or something like that, and then you're going to try a person or charge them for animal abuse, the animals that you have rescued have to be kept as evidence, and it's expensive. Usually they're kept at the local shelter or SPCA, and you have to keep these animals for months, if not years, as the case percolates along.
Right.
Well, Eau Claire's just been presented with a bill of more than $77,000 from the local Humane Association for the Care and Boarding of Animals, confiscated as evidence in two cruelty cases.
Mm.
So that's got to be a real punch in the stomach for and apparently they received, that was their discounted price. They saved 20% due to the good nature of the Humane Society. But
you think they'll be paid back?
Yeah, they'll pay him. But the remarkable thing is that holding these animals for all this time is even not that useful, because the animals, they come in sick and malnourished, and while they're in the SPCA, they eat better, they get veterinary care, and by the time the trial comes, they're fine. So the point is lost. So just your initial documentation ought to be enough, and then they ought to start the process of rehoming these animals.
Yeah.
So it's those laws really need to be updated.
Yeah. Good point.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, thanks, Peter.
Thank you, Lori.
Good news items.
Well, some of them are happy, some are not.
Yeah. We'll get an update from you about a couple of these items next week, I hope.
Yes.
And thank you for listening to Animals Today. This is Dr. Lori Kirschner encouraging you to nurture your love and compassion for the only other beings sharing our planet, the animals.